In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I had a great chat with Jack Barton. Jack is an associate for SGS Economics and Planning and also manager of stakeholder engagement and business development for the Geospatial Research, Innovation and Development Lab at the University of New South Wales. He also runs his own private practice, JBDD. Jack and I have a great discussion about how his upbringing in a regional area, his interest in cities, and his love for digital technology have all combined to spark his interest in the smart space. We talk about why smart cities is a good buzzword and the reasons connections and communication are important in smart communities. Jack shares his view on how Australia is embracing smart concepts and why long-term vision is important, especially during this age of experimental pilot programs. We cover smart city standards and what they mean for people working in the space and the importance of digital and spatial literacy and the need for more people to properly understand data so that they can use it effectively. We discuss how open data can facilitate better integration across the disciplines, government and industry, and finish our conversation on the emerging trends of boring and somewhat old-fashioned things like protocols, accountability, transparency, governance and longevity. As always, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play with smart communities. The future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Just before we get into the episode, I wanted to let you know that you can now support the Smart Community Podcast via Patreon. That's patreon.com/smartcompod with two M's. If you become a patron, you'll get a special episode each month exclusive to supporters. If you would like to feature on the Smart Community Podcast, you can also head to Patreon where you can sponsor an episode. There are options for either a full featured episode or adding a promo for your company or an event coming up. There are both once-off and monthly options. Thank you so much for your support so far. It is my dream for the podcast to be self-sustaining so it can continue to be produced for my smart community no matter what the circumstances. Enough from me, on with the episode.
Hello, Jack. How are you?
Not too bad, so how are you?
I am very well. We finally got there with technology. High five to us.
Yeah, high five.
Let's start at the start. And can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you're passionate about?
Yeah, sure. My background's actually, I grew up on an agricultural property out in northwestern New South Wales. And so I guess in regional New South Wales. And near the Warrumbungle Mountains, and I've just been out to Corinda for the David Bowie Festival, and he was out there in 1983 filming the video clip for Red Shoes, and they kind of said, why don't we have a festival out here, and that was weird, wasn't it, let's have a festival. So went out there just recently, and lots of memories came flooding back to the place, so the Warrumbungle Mountains were sort of on the horizon for where I grew up, and I'd always sort of wonder what was over the horizon. And when I'd go to school in the city, you'd sort of drive through more and more increasing urbanization, and until you're at the very exciting and beautiful Sydney Harbour, a lot of the time I had sort of the best of both worlds, I guess, and the city always fascinated me as this thing that was just sort of over the horizon. And also out in the bush, I got a lot of, I always had a real interest with technology, and I tried to merge those things, and I studied architecture, and quickly sort of, took to the computing side of that, and ended up doing a PhD designing a spatial decision support systems, particularly for management of public housing communities, high-rise public housing communities. And in that, it wasn't just a pragmatic thing about sort of joining asset databases with tenant databases, but there was a lot more issues about the actual sensitivities of the communities that live in these areas. That's where it really sort of hit me in the face, is that, you really need to have a good sense of ethics and not to use technology in a a surreptitious kind of way that might be interpreted as surveillance or spying. It has to be something that empowers the communities, that makes places better, and can help people work together as a community, which I think it's proving to do now that we're getting more advanced with it, and we're getting a better digital literacy across a lot of different communities.
Yeah. Cool.
And so, from that, I did a stint down in Melbourne for about 4 years, just over 4 years, working with a group called ORIN, the Australian Urban Research Infrastructure Network. And, I was lucky enough to be working nationally with a bit of international stuff and flying from, city to city, just running workshops and talking to academics and members of government and industry and teaching, helping people become more spatially literate. And that was a very exciting time, especially when you're looking at sort of, different disciplines and working with different multiple stakeholders, the way people can use data for their own problems. There's sort of sometimes no two of the same, but other times there are very common themes.
Yeah, I think you've answered this already, but what kind of sparked your interest in the smart city space or smart community space?
Yeah, well, that's definitely it. One thing led to another, and now it's more important than ever, really. I'm finding that it's digital technologies are really kind of these pragmatic tools that can help us make life easier, make life better, and importantly also can look at the more disadvantaged areas of cities and communities and be able to address that, at least sort of make it a bit more visible and rally some energy around helping solve those what we call wicked problems. We've got many people with different sort of motivations and no clear sort of stopping point, so there's always this element of negotiation and ongoing kind of work that needs to revolve around something, and that's where spatial coordinates come in. They're this one constant where you've always got this sense of place and space that you can hinge a discussion around.
So tell me what a smart city or a smart community means to you.
Good question. I understand you've done over 70 interviews so far, and when I've been listening to some of the previous podcasts, there's certain elements that are consistent, where people have sort of had similar things about being digitally enabled or human centric or whatever, but then also everyone's got their own sort of flavor to that as to what the smart city means to them is what they do. To me, it is, people can say, oh, it's a buzzword, but it is a very good buzzword. As soon as you say smart city, immediately, people can understand we're going to be using technologies, but that's not the answer to everything. There's a strong element of communication and, to go back to things that are, everything but technology, I guess, better communities, more green spaces, less car dependence, whatever else. I guess we've been doing a bit of work with emergency services. And one word they use a lot, which I like, is situational awareness. So I think, not only, sort of being a narcissistic smart city that just gazes inwardly, but one that can actually be aware of, its neighbours and its place in the world. I think we've got a really unique opportunity to do that at this point of time where we've got such good communication tools that are being applied for our built environments.
So why do you think that this concept is so important?
Once again, it's about connection and communication. It's when we're dealing with wicked problems that we face, like traffic congestion or environmental degradation or whatever else. We need to work hard and communicate hard to reach an optimal consensus. It's not like there's right answers or wrong answers between all these different stakeholders. So consensus building, I think, is an ongoing thing that humans, when they're living on a finite amount of resources, are always going to be having to manage, And that's where also I think it's very important to have evidence-based kind of approaches to things where we're sharing the data, objective data, and that's scientifically sort of rigorous, and then using that to base the discussions on. That's where I think the smart city concept is important. The city is the built environment is a kind of an objective thing that's out there that exists, and people can interpret it in different ways. It's just important to share what we think about those things to try to manage them in the best possible way.
Yeah, cool. I like that approach. I think that we need to, I think the question you answered before this one, talking about, communicating with our neighbours, so that kind of regional approach, and I think that's really important that we look at, you know, the built environment in that way, that it's not just a one city, we're going to do this kind of thing, because at the end of the day, yep. people want to move between cities and communicate between cities and learn from each other. So I think that's really important.
Yep. Benchmarking and, you know, being able to sort of see where you are in 5 years as to if you've achieved your aims or not as a community, as a city. And as you say too, I mean, there's been a lot of places, I shouldn't mention names, but there's been a lot of places internationally where, you know, they have had the idea of a smart city as being one where it's like, okay, this is the information city and there's just this one singular purpose, or, you know, they have been framed like that, you know, Mazda in the Emirates, the sustainable city, you know, I mean, that really sort of just had this concept and didn't quite have the things that made a working city. It didn't have the diversity and the density and the wicked problems that sometimes, you know, it sort of invigorate a city, you know, and there's been a lot of other examples like that where you might just have just one single kind of brand on a place, you know, that's just, you know, often created very rapidly. I think that sort of thing, although there might be buildings and a few people living in there, they're not, I think they've given us a good example of what not to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think that places that we live, so towns and cities and communities, are built not by putting a bunch of buildings together or whatever, but by people, right? So people congregate, and that's how the city is, or the town or region or whatever is created. So I think if you need people to be smart, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the big sort of aha moment that a lot of architectural students have, you know, is that it's, you know, it's not about the actual bricks and mortar. It's about the space in between them and how to facilitate human habitation on the planet, really, you know.
Okay. How do you think Australia, or we can go down to New South Wales, is embracing the smart concept?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it goes right up to the federal government's cities agenda and with the smart cities and suburbs way of allocating, you know, funding to different local governments and partners. I think that has been very successful so far. It's permeated a lot of different cities and regions, and engaged with SMEs quite well, I think, all the startup culture and what all the different technology providers and things. I think it's mobilised the population pretty well. What I am keen to see is how this sort of plays out in longer term. If we can really build on these things, or what might be just the, experimentation's great. But you know, I've seen a few sort of initiatives come and go, you know, in my time. I think it does need to be designed with a more long-term view, and certainly, you know, not so much tied to funding cycles, but, you know, ideally we want to be looking at a 10, 100 year kind of window into the future, especially with the challenges that we're facing right now in terms of managing populations and global warming and the technological curse of the past being the motor car. You know, I mean, we've got a very exciting future, actually, and I think technology is the thing that can give us a good smart future in light of these challenges.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we're doing a lot of short-term things with smart cities or smart technology, and I think it's important to pilot and test these things, but without a long-term, you know, goal or objective or vision, it's never going to work, because when the grant dries up, or the funding stream dries up, you actually need ways to continue these. And I think that you need to make them sustainable, I suppose, in all the senses of, you know, the word, not just environmentally, but economically as well.
Yes, you need to be able to prove and measure how sustainable they are, you know, show the evidence, you know.
Yeah.
You can say, this is sustainable, but, you know, if it only lasts 3 years, it didn't sustain, did it? You know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that type of thinking needs to be thought about at the forefront. Like, okay, once we prove this technology, where's the funding going to come from initially, and then how much are we going to save, and then where's that going to go, and where's that going to feed into? I think that that's really important, and maybe that's something that's not happening. I think it's happening definitely in certain areas and pockets and that kind of thing, but maybe on a national scale.
Yeah, well, I mean, also, it's the international standards, ISO, the International Standards Organization, is aware of this, you know, and there are some, there's some good standards in place now for, you know, how we can design our cities to be more sustainable and to measure that sustainability, what we need to have in place to do that. You know, there's quality of life indicators, ISO 37120. Then there's also ISO 37106, which is the guidance on establishing smart city operating models for sustainable communities. And they're very good documents. I mean, it sounds boring. and they, indeed, they do talk about a lot of the boring stuff that often gets missed. But, you know, we have got the structure there as set out by the ISO. And that will be interesting because that means that once you get down to the different countries, different cities and different areas that are harmonizing with these guidelines, I think you've got a very good example of standardization, you know, and that's sort of standardization that allows you the freedom, but with certain harmonizations is what made, you know, the electricity grid be able to evolve, or what made, you know, our transit systems able to be developed. You know, I mean, that is, you know, looking into history, I mean, we do need these fundamental kind of foundations in place, and we have got them. So that's, you know, can't be underestimated. You know, that's the thing that'll make it work. Without that, and what we have seen in the last few years is where you've just got different groups, different interests sort of doing their own, you know, experiments and calling it a smart, sustainable city. But, you know, when you scratch the surface, I mean, what's the longer term? What's the big vision, you know?
And I think some people working in the space probably don't even know that there are smart city standards.
Yes.
And yeah, and then, like, let alone how to use them and what they mean for, you know, local governments and other people working, you know, other businesses in the space. So I think it's a really important topic. And I think a lot of people don't think this is real, particularly, you know, maybe engineers and people that are, you know, worked in the space for not smart city space, but, you know, the built environment space for so long. But I guess it becomes very real when you've got standards and things that you can point to and say, oh, this is, you know, this is.
Well, that's it, you know. Yeah. And that's why I said it was smart cities is a buzzword, but it's a good buzzword. You know, it can corral people and align people and, you know, convey it's like the Richard Dawkins's idea of a meme. You know, it is this little kind of small package that can relay a lot of information. And although, yes, I guess in the last few years, you know, we might even be getting a kind of a buzzword fatigue, you know, and it'd be easy for people to sort of dismiss, oh yeah, smart cities, isn't that just some kind of thing that these geezers are trying to, you know, make money with or whatever, you know. But when you look into it, it is a very it's a damn serious thing, you know, because if the alternative is dumb cities, that'll be not good.
Yeah, that's 100% right. Okay. What are some of the projects and things that you're working on right now?
I've got wearing two hats right now. I'm an associate at SGS Economics and Planning, and they're an excellent team there. I'm working with them to develop their digital strategy and to plan the next few steps into the future there. And I'm also managing stakeholder engagement and business development for the Geospatial Research, Innovation and Development Lab at the University of New South Wales. That's with, once again, an excellent team led by Professor Sissy Zlatanova. And we're just sort of emerging now. We're in the first 6 months of existence, and we're scoping out a few different projects, and we've already got a few under our belt. We've been working with Fire and Rescue and a few of the other different groups, doing some laser scanning and starting to look at rapid data acquisition and how that might be used in emergency events, or be that evidence-based for the spatial environment, you know. And so we're planning a few different, you know, collaborations around that, what we can do once we've scanned and digitized cities, how then you can add value to that raw data. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I have someone I'll have have to introduce you to.
Oh, good.
We can help out with that. Or, yeah, let's chat.
No, this is the time where we're keen to be meeting people and shaking hands and, you know, letting people know that we're here to and happy to do a few projects and introduce our team. I think all the team. I'm the only local person here. All our team are from overseas, so it's been good introducing them to the Australian environment, and they bring a wealth of knowledge from TU Delft primarily, mm-hmm. and the Netherlands. You know, they do things really well over there, I think, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm heading over there next year to look at smart mobility.
Oh, that'll be good. Yeah.
Yeah, I just got a Churchill Fellowship, so.
Congratulations. Very good.
Yeah, so I'll be heading to the Netherlands amongst, I think I've got 8 countries on my list. Yeah, which should be really good.
That'll be very memorable. That's very good. Yeah.
Okay, that's enough about me. How do you think we can better integrate across the different disciplines, government, academia, and industries?
Yeah, well, multiple stakeholders of the city, and that was the that's the thing. I think, you know, good standards, like we mentioned before. I mean, they're the base, and that. Well, one thing I'll point you to is the Semantic Stack by Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the internet, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, and it's a bit similar to my other favourite little hierarchy, that sort of pyramid of data, information and knowledge. You know, with the semantic stack, you've got this kind of idea that, you know, that the data and the protocols and the standards are the foundation, and then you can build on top of them to enhance the information levels and work at that knowledge level and higher sort of human activities. And so I think we really need to, you know, have good foundations of data so that we're all sort of talking with the same protocols, but not to have that as this thing that just forces people into a particular rut. You know, you need to allow for accessibility and diversity and, you know, sort of just common concepts and openness, of course. You know, there's been a great open data movement, and that's really, you know, measurably helped with research and development and all sorts of things. In fact, in the Productivity Commission identified that if a whole lot of cancer researchers had been able to get to access the de-identified data earlier, they could have saved several lives by finding a correlation with CAT scans and cancers, you know. And so, I mean, it is the sort of thing that does save lives. You know, I mean, we need to have these systems in place for when there are inevitable emergencies and disasters and things. So I think there's a good driving motivation for that beyond the dollar value of these initiatives, you know. So, yeah, how can we better integrate across disciplines? Showing good examples, helping increase spatial literacy too, I think. You know, that's, you can't do it enough, you know, just show people what, you know, mesh blocks are and how the ABS works and how you can read and write data. I guess there's still a fear of opening up data for fear of what might happen, you know, what you might expose yourself to. Well, that's kind of a bit of a myth, you know, like it's as soon as you can sort of just de-identify the data and get it in a good, you know, looking good, you know, it opens up a lot of opportunities that wouldn't have been there before and haven't been there historically because we've just sort of been hoarding data as silos, whether we planned it or not, you know. So we're breaking silos apart, definitely. There's a lot of initiatives out there that are doing that, and it's having measurable improvements on operations, you know.
And I think you're right, data in a silo might not be really useful, but once you can correlate it, you know, in that cancer example, then, you know, you can save lives. I mean, maybe not as drastic as that every time, but like the information you can get. And I think you're right, the privacy thing needs to come into it. We know that 100%, but it doesn't mean that it just completely shuts everything down. I think that's it seems some people are really feeling black and white about it, which I think it's actually very grey. And the only way you move through grey is to exactly what you said, which is that digital or spatial literacy and just increasing it. Some of these concepts are not rocket science. They're just people just need to know about them and be able to access information and educate themselves in a really quite simple way.
Yes, and when you're talking about like grey between the black and white, I mean perhaps it's a spectrum. You know, as Kate Crawford from MIT and other groups mentions, you know, it's not this binary kind of thing. It's not sort of like public or private. You know, you've got this whole range of things. It's a bit like, I mean, taking it back to the built environment, you know, it's not like you've either got 100% public space or 100% private space. In fact, you know, you can define privacy as your ability to control your level of publicity. And so we've got to be aware that, and you know, this is another thing that will require a lot of kind of consensus. And you know, there are standards out there, but in the way that we can keep what has to be secure, because that is what, that's once again sort of an issue that can have lives at stake. But then also being able to access the data rapidly and in an authorized way is another thing that we're looking at the Grid Lab, is, you know, something where you can, when you're using, you've got multiple stakeholders and important sort of things that could go wrong. You know, it's sometimes you don't want the data to be the thing that's the weakest link, you know.
And I think what you said before about the standards, that yes, let's have standards, but they need to be agile or adaptable based on people's situations.
Yep.
And I think it's good to have that base, but then you need that level of literacy to be able to make good decisions about, you know, whether those things change or shift a little bit or pivot.
Absolutely. Yes, it's very true.
What are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough, in your opinion?
Yeah, enough is probably the important word at the end. Yeah, no, it's a tricky question. I don't know that people aren't talking about them, so I don't know. I mean, what the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough? Well, like I flagged before, I guess the boring stuff, because it's boring, but it can, with a bit of work, you can make it exciting. You know, just things like, you know, protocols and, you know, looking at really getting into the security side of things and the privacy side of things and whatever else, you know. I mean, there are such a good lot of people out there sort of working and writing on this stuff. I mean, it's hard to sort of pick something. I mean, you've all these issues about inequality, you know, that's a very important thing. You know, authors like Anthony Townsend and Ellen Broad and Kate Crawford, you know, they deal with all these sort of data ethics things, you know, very elegantly. And, you know, this is sort of something that, you know, is really critical for, you know, there's a lot of things, if we ignore data ethics, you know, it could go very wrong. So I think, you know, as important as it is, I mean, maybe it's not being talked about enough. I think, you know, there's more people that know about that and practice good ethical, you know, data management, the better, you know, and the more equipped you are to deal with it when you're exposed to potentially being a victim of unethical data practices, you can start to see where things might have gone wrong. You know, if people are releasing private identifiers or spatial identifiers or anything else like that, you know. And so what else aren't people talking about enough? I think we are seeing problems where we've got the sort of proven evidence of vendor lock-in and what might happen, you know, if a group might change, you know, move from a closed proprietary product to more of an open one. There are a lot of teething problems with that. And so we do need to, and I think the vendors are slowly catching up. They're realizing that people are using and want, and they can play in the open space. You know, they might have closed, you know, proprietary software, but as long as they're sort of inputting and outputting good open OGC formats or whatever else, you know, you've got a capacity there for using their product in a constructive, integrated way. You know, I think we've seen that this, you know, just wanting to lock people into one silo has been a bad thing. And, you know, maybe also something like the old fashioned kind of things that we aren't talking about enough, just getting back to, you know, accountability, transparency, governance, you know, those sort of things, you know, longevity, you know, maybe you could put them in the boring basket, but, you know, these are the sort of things that we need now more than ever, you know.
Yeah. I agree. I enjoy the boring stuff as well. My favorite thing is, you know, talking about signage and the future of signage.
Wow.
And it really interests me about that people don't look at signs, whereas I look at every single sign and find it fascinating. But yeah, anyway, but also government processes as well. And that incorporates so many things that I think if we can even improve one government process slightly, then, you know, it can really change the way that people can interact in a city or a town. Yep. And, you know, the amount of money we could save, so then it can be spent on the community. It comes into, you know, all those things you said as well, the boring stuff that flows down into these systems. And I think somebody needs to be thinking about the boring stuff, so then we can look at all the cool, shiny, fun stuff, because that's, everyone wants to be in that space. But if you don't sort out the boring things first, then we can only, you know, step one step forward and then 10 back and then keep going like that. Whereas I think, yeah, if you get your ducks in a row, and you know, it'll change. That's the other thing too. You need to be using your word a lot, that, you know, that literacy is so important, because then you can actually make decisions when things go wrong, like you said. Whereas if you don't know what's happening, something goes wrong, then you're likely, and you know, you're likely to just say, okay, well, that didn't work. Let's never do anything like that again.
Yeah.
And that's a real shame, yeah. You know?
And never before have we had this sort of amazing cumulative digitized knowledge bank as a species, you know? So it really is in our hands to do something with it. It's, you know, a good way to take us into the future, you know? And there's a lot of work in that for many people. I guess that's the point, you know? It's many stakeholders.
Definitely. And I mean, it's one of the reasons that, you know, you say, like, we've got this kind of community of digital, I don't know what the word would be. We've just got this hub of people that are so willing to help, because to increase that level of education, that using literacy again, but and it's never, I don't think we've ever had that before, because we can connect now so easily. And I mean, that's why I started the podcast, really, because I wanted to make it accessible for everyone, like the community can listen, as well as, you know, government agencies can listen. Everyone can get something out of it.
Yep.
And then also connect with the people that have come on there, because I have the amount of conversation I have that people are just keen to collaborate, you know, and because I feel like if you do good work, then, you know, you'll have the next job and the next job and the next job.
Yes, and that's also been one of the things where I've personally found a real benefit of using open source software. Like my favorite geographic information system is QGIS, and I've run many workshops internationally and a few internationally with that. And one time I had a great time over at as a guest at the Far Eastern University in Manila, and I was expecting it to be really difficult to, you know, set up the lab or whatever, but you know, open source. You know, you just download it, put it in there. You're doing it all completely by the terms and conditions, and then you can be in a completely different country and all be on the same page, you know, within minutes. And then you can start to look at the, you know, the humanitarian OpenStreetMap stuff or whatever else, and teach people about how to use GIS. And then while they're actually solving problems, you know, particularly you might be able to sort of identify a disaster area and then start to build up, show where the road networks are, and you're up and running. So, I mean, the metabolism of these things is really quite impressive. You know, I'm interested to see what it'll be like in the next 10 or 100 years, you know.
Me too. Oh, it's been so great to talk to you today, Jack. Thanks so much for coming on to the podcast.
Cheers, eh?
I just have one last question, which is, how can people connect with you?
My Twitter handle is JBDD. That's Juliet Bravo Delta Delta. And on LinkedIn, I'm Jack Barton Digital. And I Google pretty well, I think. I've got a web page. It's just sort of like an online brochure, but a goofy kind of thing left over from 20 years ago, which I irregularly update. And that's jbdd.com. But it's only for the hardcore, you know. Well, I mean, people that are interested in boring stuff.
I'll have to go have a look now. Well, thanks, Jack. I'll put all the links in the show notes, and people will be able to click away and connect with you. I really look forward to meeting you in person someday. I think we'll have lots to chat about.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Jack.
Yes, thank you very much.
Talk soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community or find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter @smartcompod. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears, so thank you in advance. As always, I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.